Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is composer John Merman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Stuart.
It's a pleasure having you on. Now, you're a composer living in Maine who writes music for choirs, movies, orchestras, soloists, kids' shows, commercials, church, and more, according to your biography. You also play piano, sing, conduct, are percussionist, accordionist, and much more. I mean, I thought the story about the what you did with the Immaculate Heart of Mary Parish in Auburn with this 1954 organ that was reconstructed. I mean, it sounds like it was recent, but how recent was that? Was that something? Was that this year? Last year?
That was 2019. My wife and I were living briefly in Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
and we wanted to come back. Yeah, we wanted to come back Maine, and I had a colleague who was an organist who called me, and they were looking for an organist at a local church.
Mm.
And it was actually a great opportunity because we almost moved to Arizona
for
a similar thing. And that didn't work out. And that's far from, you know, family, friends. And
it
became like this big coronavirus hotspot, you know, where we were and we had our son was just about to be born. And then we got this call saying, oh, you want to come do this job in Maine? How opportune. And my wife's parents are in Maine. Mine are in New Hampshire. So with the son coming on the way, it was very convenient. And yeah, I came into this job not ever having learned to play the organ.
No way.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I'm just a pianist. So, I know where to put my fingers.
Of course.
But, I had always wanted the opportunity to learn to play the organ, actually. And the
is it more physical though compared to playing the piano?
Oh, it's more physical. I'd kind of opposite in a way. It's almost more. I've learned to think of it as you're playing multiple flutes.
Okay.
And it's really for me, it's a lot more listening. I mean, physical in terms you have to use your legs, but you don't feel the physical feedback of the instrument in the way that you do with the piano. It doesn't come into your hands.
Mm.
You know, it comes from the pipes that are around you. But yeah, I came in and we didn't have the organ at the time. And 6 months after I started this job, we had this old electronic Allen thing. And then they were just at the end of the process of bringing this beautiful organ from a convent in the Midwest that I think was closing.
Yeah.
And, installed it. They had a local organ builder build this beautiful case, put all the pipes in, and then COVID happened, really 2 months later. And
wow.
So I've just, the past year, I've just been able to practice the organ, like 20 hours a week.
It won't surprise people tuning into Britflix podcast that we've come to talk about your film composition work, and in particular, the score you did for Honeydew, which was a film that I saw at Fright Fest back in the autumn, and I referred specifically to your skin-crawling atonal score, which, having listened to it all now, because it's now available for people to listen to in its own right outside of the film, there's a lot more going on. I mean, I think in some ways, if I put on my music journalist hat on for a second, there's like, for me, listening to it as a whole piece of work, it's got sort of the fractious electronica of, say, early noughties Warp records. And then, in other ways, it feels like it's holding hands with the poison nature that's the story of the film. So it feels very real, but also very artificial. It's sort of almost, in some ways it goes between sort of a sledgehammer to crack a nut and very subtle at the same time sometimes. And it's sort of, it's a really uncomfortable and physical experience to hear it that way. And obviously when you hear it in connection with the film, that's what gives it a presence. I felt like Devereaux Millburn, director, didn't shy away from indulging himself in using what music you provided. It's got such a presence in the film. And it reminded me of Mark Corvin's score for The Witch or David Julian's score for The Descent, in the sense that they've both got that ability to be as uncomfortable away from the film as they have when you watch the film.
Well, you know, actually, I was hesitant about making a standalone album from the movie because of that, because it's so integrated with the film itself. I was like, well, I don't think it really needs to have an album aside from it. And, you know, I'm glad we ended up doing it, but the whole process of writing the music was so bound up with the editing of the movie. It was from November of 2018 until June 2019. Devereaux and I were just back and forth all the time. And I'd send him a little clip of some music I was working on, and then he'd re-edit something, and then I'd send him more music.
Before we get too much into that, then let's just start the beginning of the story. Then, Honeydew, the soundtrack, the score is available to buy and list stream. So starting at the beginning, and for people who, and I know there are different point jumping off points in terms of when a composer gets involved. Let's start with how you got chosen to score Honeydew first.
Sure.
How did that come about? So
the cinematographer and co-screenwriter, Dan Kennedy, was a longtime friend of mine. I think we knew each other since we were middle school age. And I wrote the music for his directorial debut, Loud Places. And I think actually when we were in high school, we might have done something together for fun. So it's great to see these sort of echoes through our lives. But we did Loud Places together, which is completely different music, more, you know, deliberately beautiful sort of sounding music.
Yeah.
Which obviously Honeydew is not. And of course, Dan went to college, I believe, with Devereaux and NYU, and they were both film students. And then so Devereaux was looking for a composer, and Dan said, oh, check out John's music. And I think he sent Devereaux, it was interesting because he sent Devereaux the Loud Places music. And also, what was really fun is that I showed him some music that I had, you know, sitting in the box on the shelf for years that I'd written 10 or 15 years before.
Yeah.
Instrumental pieces that he really loved, and I'd never really gotten any traction with them, that had a particular kind of rhythmic quality to them that he was like, oh, that's, I want that. And actually in the early version of the movie, he had put some of those in the movie. So that's how we got started.
At what point in the film's journey did Devereaux get you involved with creating the score?
When they were filming, really. I was in touch with Dan. I think it was late summer. I think my wife and I just came back from our honeymoon in August 2018, and I got a text from Dan, and they were about to film. I think they were filming in September.
Yeah.
And so I went out on set, you know, and I think just one day, might have been two, but I went out and saw how boring it is to make a movie, which was... There's so much support. The poor actors, you know, take after take, sitting, you know, let's do it again. Let's do it again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which was new for me. You see the final product and, you know, how exciting it is.
No, indeed, indeed. So if you were involved as in the film's being shot, so you're aware of what it is. Presumably you've got a script.
That's right. I had the script. That was the first thing they sent me, the script. I read through it. I thought it was really weird. You know, I was like, I don't know. My first reaction was, I don't watch horror movies. I don't know if I'm the guy. I don't know anything about them. But it appealed to me. And you know, the even in the script, you can perceive all the twists and turns in it. And also the kind of, there's a weird sense of humor in the movie too.
For sure.
That you could get through the script. And so that idea of coming to the set, I remember reading Philip Glass's autobiography that he wrote a couple of years ago, and he was talking, I think, about Koyaanisqatsi, or maybe the sequel to that. I can't remember the name of it.
Okay.
And how it was the sequel to that. And there's this opening scene of how, and he went there when they were filming, and I think it was in somewhere in South America, and there's this scene of them mining for gold or diamonds or something. And it's, you know, we assume this is this horrible sort of thing, right? They're in this awful labor conditions, but he's got this like children's choir with trumpets playing. And I guess someone said to him, why did you do that? You know, it's this like slave labor situation. He said, yeah, he said, you think that's what this is about. Actually, he said, I was there. And these guys are like, they love this. They're so excited. Like they find it like a diamond and they run off to the, you know, the market or wherever to sell it. And it's like, so I was thinking I have to be there. Because there's things I can't imagine until you're there. And intangible things you can't anticipate. And one of them was, and I'm so happy to see Devereaux talk about this in interviews I've seen him do, the sounds of being out there in the summer in New England at night. You have crickets and cicadas and frogs and things like that. The sound of the wind. And so actually resonated with an experience I'd had maybe 10 years earlier, being outside in the early springtime and listening to the sound of the spring peepers, little frogs, and the rhythms of their noises, which are kind of these roiling polyrhythms that kind of, you get closer to one and you can hear some emphasized, and you get closer to da, 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 and they're over each other. And I remember going back and transcribing some of these rhythms, recording them and transcribing them. And so when I went to the set of Honeydew, I did the same thing. I took my little voice recorder and, you know, and transcribed some of these rhythms and the rhythms of the, you know, cicadas and people. Well, there probably weren't any peepers in September, but
yeah,
frogs and crickets. So it literally, you know, the sound of the set informed the music. And so when you have this sort of seeming chaos or like organic oozing of sounds, it's because of that idea.
Yeah, because that's something that comes across really strongly with when you watch the film, and certainly if you're able to sort of indulge yourself with either seeing it in the cinema or put your headphones on, is that your music and the sound of the place are often fighting with each other, really, in some ways. It's like it's all of one and none of the other and vice versa. So there's times when the film just naturally exists. There's no music whatsoever, and then there's other times where everything that's real disappears and your music becomes the tone of the film. When I wrote the review of the film, it's your music in the first half of the movie, because like you say, there's like a dark sense of humour going on that you're not quite understanding, and there's no way of guessing where the horror's going to come from and where it will end, and I'm not going to spoil it in this conversation, but for much of that part there really is just your music telling us and reminding us we're watching a horror film and to be ready for it.
And people have mentioned that too. It's, you know, you look at the scene and they're eating dinner, right, but then you're hearing this, it's sort of all these weird, you know, sounds going on. So it's sort of a cue that things aren't quite. Right. And the scraping blades, you know.
Yeah, the blade on whetstone and things like that. That's.
It's just our kitchen knives. I think we got as a wedding present or something that I'm sharp, you know, just sharpening.
So in that sense, I mean, I've interviewed, goodness gracious, what they called. There's an experimental electronic band whose name escapes me now, but they did a whole album based on samples of plastic surgeons doing operations.
Ooh.
So it's a really, you know, it's a genuinely visceral experience.
Yeah.
But then when you know what it is, it's sort of twice as visceral.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of these things, I actually had no idea about these. What's called... you know, the people listen to sounds.
AMSR.
Yeah, AMSR. I didn't know about this. And, you know, people saying, oh, it's like ASMR. And it's so funny because I said, I guess so. It was really, you know, Devereaux had a lot to do with this, because I would send him at first things for instruments. Oh, here's something for the piano, here's a little beautiful tune, or violin, whatever. And he's, I don't know. You know, he kept saying, let's do something stranger. And I think that the first time I sent him a track of me doing these rhythms on my cheeks, basically, and making sound effects. And he was so excited. He was like, oh. And he couldn't have known it at the time that, you know, there's a particular thematic element about somebody's cheeks that are, you know, maybe become a meal at some point. And then, that I wasn't even thinking about that. And I mentioned that to Deborah after the fact.
The penny's just dropping now for me, to be honest with you, as you're saying it.
Yeah, it's such an Easter egg. I shouldn't even tell you. People should, like, you know, film students of the future can find this out on their own. But it was unconscious at the most, but it was really cool. I realized that, oh, cheeks, there's so much cheeks in this. And there's this line where, that's my cheek.
Well, I'm glad you told me though, because I was, while focusing on trying to understand what it was you were doing, I'd wrote down, is he tapping on a UPVC pipe? Is he flicking his teeth? I couldn't quite work out what it was, but now,
you change the shape of your mouth, changes the pitch, and
yeah.
And there's glass, you know, water. We have these giant wine glasses, and I just kind of fill them up with water and tap them while I'm tapping them, you know, shift them around and the pitch shifts.
I mean, I think for anyone that sees the film, I mean, the opening 2 minutes or so almost sets the mood of the film anyway, in terms of what you're giving to the movie, because you've got this kind of almost like doomy choir sound is the best way I could describe it. For the girl eating the steak and eggs while reading what appears to be Bible passages or some quasi-religious stuff. But then it cuts hard to the funeral sequences, and then we've got this more almost like tinnitus sound going on. So we've got this ethereal moment, but this really ugly eating of steak and eggs, and then this really visceral attack, which is meant to be a moment of solemnity as well, you know, and we're not I wrote down when I was getting ready for this conversation, you know, it sort of sets a pattern for the entire film at that point.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And that dichotomy.
Yeah.
Right. That was actually probably the first track that we did that I was like, okay, this is onto something unique for this movie.
Hmm.
And it was really just me kind of mumbling nonsense, you know, in harmony. And it's something I've done with, like with Gregorian chant. I found if you need to have at least usually like three people in the same vocal register, like three men, three women, to have the sound of a blended voice. I would do each pitch in, you know, there's harmony, but I do each pitch three times, you know, so I'm one recording and then another one and then record the harmony parts with that. And it's really just kind of, you know, nonsense mumbling.
And how does, I mean, I'm fascinated then given the level of experimentation that's going on there, because that's not scoring music in a kind of traditional notation and melody or rhythm or even, you know, beats and stuff. It's like this is about creating musical sounds which are almost punctuation, aren't they, rather than tunes, if that makes sense.
Well, I've been thinking a lot about this. There, in my head right now, there's sort of three different modes of making music that I vacillate, you know, between these different ones. One of them is just pure improvisation, right? Which happens live, happens once, it's gone. And then there's, of course, you take a score, you write the music down so it can be perfectly reproduced. And the other one, there's this sort of third way, which is what you're describing, which is like sound sculpture, where you're making a recording, you add something else to it, you make little tweaks. And that's kind of somewhere in between the two, because a lot of times with this, and for Honey, I'll write, I write sketches of scores. If there is a harmony part, I'm writing out what that should be. You know, if there's particular notes or rhythms, I write, sketch them out. Mm. But then there is a lot of improvisation that happens into the microphone, and just in layers, and then, you know, editing them and, you know, manipulating them.
And if we talk about a couple of specific scenes, because I think it would be, it's kind of instructive as to almost illustrating how obtuse the music that you scored can be compared to what was seen. And I think the example you gave of was it Philip Glass, did you say, was talking about the idea of this music being over here and the image being somehow at the complete opposite end of what it was illustrating. And it's a really simple one. It's the scene with Riley and Sam when they're having sex in the tent.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the image is like almost like looking through a telescope anyway, so it's very voyeuristic.
Yeah.
But there's nothing sexy about the music that's been put to it.
Well, I have to be honest, I didn't put that music there.
Yeah.
I was surprised when I saw the final cut that was the music, because that was actually, that's me, and it comes back later. And then, and there's places where Devereaux did that, where he put music from earlier.
Yeah.
And moved it around. So that was actually, that kit was originally for the scene where they're on the post and Ulysses is coming in. Mm. And just before the, well, I don't want to spoil too much.
I know what you mean. So we'll carry on. Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's this building up of tension, and that's when that is the same chanting with the driving tension.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And Devereaux took that and put it in that scene in the tent. So yeah, I can't take responsibility for that particular placement.
But that's interesting then, because I think for someone who might be doing their first composition or a filmmaker trying to find a collaborative process with their composer, there's no straight line between what music you get to go on a film and what you don't get, is there?
Yeah. And there's a misperception, I think, a lot of people, they see a movie and they say, oh, look at how Hans Zimmer built up this big climax here going into the scene. Well, it doesn't take into, especially with digital editing film now, you know, how the director is able to, you know, tweak the image to fit that music exactly.
And yeah,
takes music, puts it in other places. I remember being in a film composition class in college. And I think the teacher had done a lot of this kind of thing, because a lot of it was that, oh, look at how this composer was able to build the timing of this scene up, the tension. But in reality, there's so much more back and forth, probably now more than there used to be in the past, because, you know, the director, he's editing while I'm still writing music. It's like he can take things I've written, put them over there, re-edit his scene to make them really integrated.
Can you talk about a scene then where there was that specific backwards and forth where you've been asked to do music for a scene that ended up being it, and the back and forth that happened?
Yeah, I would say a good example would be, there's a particular cameo with that comes in towards the end of the movie, and this character kind of appears, and there's this kind of mumbling, and there's scraping, mumbling. Actually, there's like a weird sort of horn sound, which is me blowing into our neighbor's garden hose. And that's a scene, yeah, where he had early on, because we hadn't gotten to that point in the film, taken other tracks I'd done, and he sort of got as much as he possibly could out of them. It was, things were repeating themselves. So then this was a scene that we really went back and forth, and with that sort of the timing adjustments, and oh, we need more. We need another, you know, 3 minutes here to stretch through this whole scene. Because at first, I asked him, can you give me timestamps throughout the whole movie? Where do you want music? And that particular whole section was several different, oh, timestamp here, timestamp here. And I was like, well, can't we just think of this as a whole scene from the time
Okay.
they're sitting up on this post, you know, through the end of it. And that made it much more manageable for me to think of it that way rather than little snippets.
Was, I mean, in a bit that stood out for me in terms of the choices outside of what you would consider to be rhythm and melody is the sudden jumps, starts and stops that happen during, say, when Sam has his midnight feast. That sequence in particular seems to, one, lull me into relaxing at one point and then it wants to stab me at the next point. And I'm not quite sure why. And then you've got the image of Goonie appearing from nowhere.
Yeah, he's there.
So you've got the action doing stuff. So in a way, it felt like for me, and I've never noticed this before when I don't always look at scores as closely as I might do with this one we're talking about, but it certainly felt to me like the music was, it was like the music was acting alongside the characters in a way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I actually watched it when we had it for the, it was the Nightstream Festival, I think was when we first, the first festival we premiered it at. And I was sitting with a friend of mine watching it. And he said, oh yeah, he said the music was like its own character, the whole thing.
Mm.
And that has so much to do with Devereaux's editing too, because he, like I said, there's places that I wrote it specifically, and then there's a place where he snipped things up and put them in, and in ways that surprised me when I watched it.
I guess the hardest part of your role in this film was that initial conversation and agreeing, no, that's what I want, and you're suddenly running with this freedom to blow into your neighbor's hose and flick your cheeks or whatever else you might want to do.
Yeah, exactly. And just getting to that point, and I just remembered walking, you know, my wife coming home one day, she went out for a walk with her friend and she came back, and it was a particular moment early on where Sam and Riley are walking to Karen's house and there's a bear trap that appears suddenly.
Hmm.
There's sort of this fun music. It's like, wah, wah, wah. This sort of like silly music. And then all of a sudden there's this like, jump scare. And it was just, I was just kind of like yipping and clapping and making, and my wife came out to play. I was like, oh, check out. She's like, is this what you've been doing? It's so, you know, you're getting paid to be your, you know, your weirdest possible self here. Just.
You mentioned early on about how when you're on set, the importance of hearing the real sounds, and obviously there's also sound design in and amongst that real sound and what you're providing with the music. So how much collaboration was there between you and the sound department? And in particular, I'm thinking sort of Romain and Sturmer and Camille Thomas, who are credited as Foley artists. Did you do anything direct with them? Or
No, I think I met them on set, I believe, but I never actually, we never corresponded. So Devereaux would have been our intermediary there.
Got you.
Yeah.
In that sense then, what would you say was the sort of most challenging aspect then of making the score for this film as you, because you're obviously in once you're back at home and you're in your studio, you're in isolation. Obviously you can send stuff in for a response, but while you're creating, you're doing that without an audience, aren't you? So what for you was the most challenging aspect?
The hardest part was just the sheer quantity of music. And that was because of that back and forth. So I laid it all out actually one point. I think I wrote about 4 hours of music.
Gee whiz.
Yeah. You know, a lot of it was just the same stuff, a little bit different, you know?
Yeah.
And I was happy to do it. You know, we just, you know, I'd make something different. Oh, that's, I really like this. Can you make it with, and so then we go ahead and do that.
So it's a bit like your music. So going back to that idea that your music was a character, it was like, here's take one, here's take two.
Yes.
And let Devereaux pick the take sometimes of what he would prefer the most.
Yeah. You know, and sometimes there, you know, there'd be disagreement there as to what we, you know, but I always had to, and as a composer, I always had to say, well, the director is the one with the bird's eye view of what this whole film needs.
Yeah.
So I might have a preference because, like, I musically, I like this particular thing, but it might not be, you know, the best thing for that scene.
Yeah, and because of the visceral nature of a lot of the music that you've provided, it's not always in the bounds of what you would call taste. You know, it's not like, you know, I don't hum a lot of what you've done. I'm not going to be humming a lot of what you've done. I mean, there are signature moments, but largely there's elements of what makes it effective, which is just the mechanics of music, but it isn't enjoyable. And that sounds like it's not a pejorative word. It's
no, I'll take that as a compliment, I think.
No, please do.
No, well, it's, you know, it's funny. I've been thinking about this a lot with, especially with film music, because you know, a lot of like the superhero movies you kind of go to, and they'll have these sort of nebulous orchestral scores, not necessarily tuneful. Some of them are, some of them not. And I know that's a lot on the directors and producers don't want the music to be tuneful. But I think when I watch it, why does it need to be a string orchestra? A string orchestra, you need a string orchestra if you want to write parts out for people to play. That's kind of hard to do if you're doing body percussion and household sound effects. But if you're making all the recordings yourself with a microphone in your living room, why does it have to be instruments that, you know, pianos and violins? Why can't it be whatever sound you can think of?
So you've mentioned a few ideas of what you've translated into sounds that became the score for the film. What's your kind of favorite in sort of inventive use of sound that you've then applied to this score?
Well, we talked about the hose horn, which is not an invention of mine. That's a known entity. Yeah, and I'm hesitant to say exactly what it is. So there are what people have mistaken as a theremin, or, you know, Devereaux wanted a musical saw early on. And I actually talked with a friend of mine who's a cellist. I said, oh, can you play a musical saw? And he said, oh, yeah, I could. So we were kind of thinking about that. And then I was just experimenting one day at home, and I was able to come up with this sound that ended up being the musical saw. There's a lot of stuff with water glasses, just sort of creating a sustained kind of unsettling harmony. I think if you listen to the soundtrack album, there's a track, I think it's The Box, which as it gets into it, gets into the cheek slapping. And then there's these sustaining tones, which are, so it's water glasses. But then I do a lot to the sounds, distort them. And you put me on the spot, and I'm thinking there's lots of silverware. If it's real silver, like a silver fork, it's got a great tinging kind of sound. There's lots of cheek slapping, lots of stomach slapping, little that sort of stuff. And then I transpose the sound way down. Oh, there's actually one. There's a deep bell that comes in a few times. Boom, boom. And it's actually just one of those same wedding glasses. Giant wine glasses, and I just transpose it down 2 or 3 octaves.
Oh, wow.
So it sounds like this giant deep bell.
I mean, I'm a big fan of drone rock music and doom jazz, which, you know, they're forms of music that on the surface they're not very melodic, but you as the listener, I think, end up tuning into oscillation somewhere in it because it becomes enjoyable. And I think that's a lot of what over the piece of the film your score does, is that even the jarring bits you become accustomed to because they happen so regularly. They're no less surprising, but they become the language of the film. So you begin to tune into it. And that's something that I remember when I was reviewing the film, is that the effectiveness of the movie, because like we said at the beginning of the conversation, for the first half of the film, you know you're in a horror film, but nothing horrible has really happened. There's clearly clues, and it's obviously off its head.
Yeah.
But you're not thinking this is Saw at that moment by any stretch of imagination. But the music that Devereaux has chosen to use of yours alongside the, you know, Betty Boo on the TV or Popeye, you know, which has got that kind of oldie analog rough sound to it, which sounds horrible, so therefore adds to a horror sound in a way.
Yes. Well, you're making me think of other sounds too. So I'm getting distracted back in the other direction.
Well, I'll tell you where the two work together that really, really is affecting is the bit where that Riley and Sam are being shown to their room for the night mm-hmm. by Karen.
Yeah.
And you've got that, I'm guessing it's cable access TV star doing his warbling.
Yeah. Yeah,
and then there's your atonal stuff, but people are still talking. There's not like, it's not like the sound is just there present. It's in addition to talking and a guy singing.
And a lot of those are, you know, there's a lot of whistling that I'll do in specific harmonies and then, you know, fiddle with the sounds digitally. Mm. And singing in different registers and particular harmonies. And then, of course, the body percussion and, you know, playing on glasses. And then there's some other things, too. Like, I had this rhythmic thing that comes in at one point, and it was a combination of me tearing a piece of paper and turning the water faucet on. So it was like... So there's lots of stuff like that throughout. It could be make a long list of them, but
no, it's amazing. No, it's interesting to sort of hear the complexity and the layers. It's like it's almost like you've turned the way you're describing it and the very real objects that aren't musical instruments is that you've it's like left field Foley, for want of a better expression.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny too because I remember as I'm coming so the last couple of weeks before my son was born, we were at my father and mother-in-law's house because that's where the baby was going to be born. There was a great big room there. And so I'm at their house trying to finish up the movie and I'm trying to find weird sounds and things. And I was asking my mother-in-law, always there, I need a sound that makes, you know, like a clanging metal or something kind of sound. And it's not always what you expect. You look at an object, and you say, oh, what about this bell? You know, like the actual sound itself is not going to. And what I found was these little cast iron figurines that were in the fireplace. And I picked them up and struck them with a drumstick. And I said, oh, that's the sound, you know.
No, well, there's a techno artist called Spooky who there's in his music, there's these like almost like they sound like the laser sounds in a Star Wars movie, really.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a wrench hammer on the cable of a pylon.
Yeah.
And then he's twiddled with the octaves or whatever. But essentially that's the root of the noise you're hearing is just a wrench hammer against a taut piece of steel.
I remember listening to a conversation with a Foley artist once and him saying, the interviewer asking, oh, what was this sound? That's a wet chamois cloth. What about the stabbing? A wet chamois cloth. What about a punch? It's a wet chamois cloth.
Well, yeah. The other one is the lettuce, isn't it? Is the knife in a lettuce, the knife, right. the tearing of a lettuce.
Yeah, it's just that whole movie magic thing. It's like even for visuals, it's not what you assume would be the best thing that will be the best thing that will come across in the movie.
Yeah, and also, I guess you're trained to make music, but obviously music for film has got a job beyond what you might make music for an audience for, even though there's an audience for the film, it has to function like the director wants it to rather than entertain, which I guess, you know, I'm simplifying what music might be for, traditionally speaking. Your willingness to experiment knows no bounds in a sense. It's like, and it's interesting what you describe with your three different sort of modes of music. Cause I, as a writer, I mean, every day I write a 1,000-word short story, stream of conscious in the morning, which has got nothing in common with how I might work with a producer talking about an idea. And it's certainly got nothing like how I would sit down and start writing pages of a screenplay, but they're all writing.
One of my favorite ways of writing music is that working from the outside in, which is like how Beethoven wrote, how Schoenberg wrote, you know, having a sense of what's the overall picture here. And, you know, I'm working on this thing right now, this school that I've taught at for a long time now, and it's our 10th anniversary. We're making like a a video for all the kids to play their part, sort of thing.
Got you.
And I'm doing, and I went back to minimalist music, process music, and you take a fundamental idea, make an overall form out of it, and then work in towards the micro, which is in some ways the opposite of what I'm doing here with film, because with film, it's wonderful because the form is already made. I don't have to worry about the form. The form is write some music that goes from, 5 minutes, 22 seconds to 11 minutes and 45 seconds.
You know what lane you're in at the very least.
Yeah, I love it. It's the same thing with choral music. Choral music is wonderful because, if you want, there's a form right there, which is the text. Just use the text as your form. So I like it when the form is suggested. Form is difficult in music. I think it's probably harder than, say, painting, where your form is you have this canvas, fill it up. But in music, the form is time. So.
So in that sense, then, when you're coming, so the conversations with Devro, it's all very well for him to go, like that. And then you come off the call and you're like, all right, then you go scratch your head, go, like what again? Like that? And it's kind of like, and if you're thinking of the mic, because in that sense, you're at the micro moment, aren't you? And the possibilities can go anywhere, can't they?
Yes. Well, and that's kind of one of the spots where you just have to, the first thing you do is you sort of trust your instincts and just do what you think is going to work great there.
Hmm.
I think, working with Devro, that is mostly the case, which is wonderful. Sometimes you get into a situation where you're like, this is the best thing I've ever written. I'm so happy with this. You give it to and they're like, not quite what we're looking for. Sorry, can you try again? But you can't try again because you already just gave it everything you had, right?
Yeah. I was going to say, that doesn't sound too dissimilar from a screenwriter's experience, to be honest with you. It's kind of, you're giving in your draft and you're hoping to get a pat on the head so you can carry on with something
new. Yeah,
you're
like, this is amazing. This is the best thing I've ever written, right?
Yeah.
And then they're like, nah, could you do it again and make it sound exactly like this other thing, but not exactly like it.
I mean, just as an abstract thought, rather than specifically about just thinking about the role of the composer, how useful or not useful do you find a guide track as a composer coming to do a project?
That's a great question. It depends on who the director is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So working with Devro was great because he was not wedded to his temp tracks. He did have some temp tracks in the music,
mm-hmm.
But they were starting points. So he had this idea that I remember at the beginning he wanted steel drums, which we kind of got very far away from. He was listening to some sort of steel drum orchestra.
Hmm.
And the whole driving scene at the beginning, he had this idea he wanted steel drums. And I ended up taking this little glockenspiel and sort of rolling notes on it. And I tried putting screws in my piano and stuff and, trying to make it sound like a steel drum. And then he sent me, and actually this was really key, was this, I had never seen Punch Drunk Love.
Okay, the Paul Thomas Anderson film.
Yes. And the soundtrack for that, which is very rhythmic and unusual. And I remember listening to it and not being sure how the sounds were made. And I, sometimes as a composer, you hear something like that, you're like, oh man, I wish I could make it sound like that. I can't do that. And that was the impetus for the, because it was some sort of like drum sound, but it had an electronic feeling to it.
Hmm.
That's when the cheek popping thing started. Cause I was like, that's kind of, maybe it's sort of like a cheek popping.
Got you.
So, in that case, when you're working with someone like that, who's just using it as watch this film. This score is really effective in this way. There was actually, what was the name of the movie? There was, I wish I could remember it. It was about a guy. It was a recent film. I think it was on Netflix, about a guy who, this crazy family killed his family or something, but they got away with it. And now they're getting out of jail.
Oh, Blue Ruin.
Yes, exactly, Blue Ruin. And he, the score for that, which is sort of this, sort of oozing, moaning, sort of sirens, sort of shifting, like you're saying, drone music. So I watched that, and of course, since I kind of a wimp with thrillers and things like that, I would sort of scroll ahead on Netflix to see, like, oh, does he get whacked? Oh no, he's good.
Okay.
Yeah. It was funny too. I read somewhere, I think it was in a review, that someone said, oh, the music is, you know, he's clearly kind of ripping off The Shining. And I was like, actually, I don't think I've ever actually watched all of The Shining. Well, so don't tell Deborah, sorry, if he hears this.
But in a way though, John, who's ripping off The Shining? Because like you've described, the process of you making 4 hours of music, yeah, discussing it backwards and forwards, and then Devereaux in the edit, then choosing, but then changing his mind, what to do with that music he's choosing, is not ripping off anything. That's a
I just thought it's really actually kind of, it amused me to read that, because I do know the music that's in The Shining quite well, a lot of it, because it uses Bartok's strings percussion and celeste quite a lot.
Yeah.
And that's a piece I've really studied. It's extremely rigorous in its form. Like every note is accounted for. The structure is built along the Fibonacci series, golden ratio, which is nothing like Honeydew's music. So I read that and I thought that's quite amusing. You know, that's, you know, people mishear things. They say, oh, this sounds like somebody plucking his teeth, right? Or that sort of thing. Or this is just like, you know, the music from The Shining. I say, well, this is probably as far from Bartok as you could get in terms of its disordered quality.
Can you, with your familiarity of that music, because I don't know it as a, mm-hmm, I know it as the score to The Shining, but I don't know it as Bartok's music.
Yeah.
Do you understand what they're hearing though, that's making them think it's like The Shining?
Yeah, they hear atonality.
Okay. So it's that element of Bartok they're hearing. So they're just marrying the two up.
Yeah, exactly. So, where his atonality is, you know, extremely ordered, like a lot of times. So, you know, instead of like a C major chord, he'll take a C and then mirror an interval, you know, down, up and down against that, you know, I don't want to get too technical, but if I had my keyboard turned on, I could just play it for you. Maybe I should do that, but no, I've got my head. That won't work. But
it's okay. No, I kind of get, because that's one of the things that certainly comes across in the film, is that there are moments where the music is fighting itself, for want of a better expression. You know, that what you're providing us with is a challenge to us to understand, because we're trying to, it's almost like as an audience, we're trying to understand it. And I think, and that's maybe why people, why a reviewer may well see The Smartest, because I think in The Shining, there's not a lot going on until the finale.
Yeah,
there's only really the presence of the music that makes, again, that makes you believe you're in a horror film.
Oh, that's a great analogy then. Yeah,
that's just my thoughts. I can't claim what the reviewer was thinking, but yeah, I can see how, because I think that's what, and knowing it's a collaboration between you and Devereaux is the important thing, I think, for anyone listening in as a director or as a composer, because it isn't about one person getting their own way or not getting their own way, as it were. I mean, obviously that it can boil down to that, I'm sure. But there's music, like you talked about, there's time and it needs filling with music and you've been asked to provide it. And Devereaux's got the problem of, is that the right music or is that not? And there's only so far you can backwards and forwards between driving each other mad. And therefore, like you said, it can end up being he'll take some other music that was for somewhere else and go, hold on a minute, this now works for that. And you're not in control of that then, are you? You've provided the music, but not for that moment.
Right. Well, and that's where I think the improvisatory nature of how this worked was a real virtue. It's not like I spent, you know, 3 weeks scoring something for an entire symphony. Mm. We went to the studio, recorded it. You know, the studio paid 100 musicians. And then in the editing room, that scene gets cut. It was, you know, it was me making up sounds and fiddling at home. So in that way, you know, a much more direct process and not quite as much cost involved. So I was just kind of creating this big bucket of music for Deborah to play with. In a lot of ways, sometimes, you know, I hope mostly for specific moments, but then other times, you know, take it from here and say, oh, maybe that works pretty well here.
Well, look, for the most part, it's a fantastic score for a fantastic film. Last thing I haven't mentioned, because I didn't know, so it just dawned on me. Now I listened to it through Spotify, which obviously is not the greatest way for you to receive money for the music. Is there going to be a physical release of the score as well, or is there a physical release?
There is. Spart Records, the Finnish label, is going to... somewhere down a couple of months down the road. I'm not sure exactly the timeline, but it's in the works. And yeah, and it's on iTunes and Amazon, so it can be purchased.
Brilliant. Well, we'll put links in the show notes to where it can be purchased as well as streamed.
Yeah.
And it just gives me to say thank you very much for giving us your time on the BritFlix podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much, Stuart.
How to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.